For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about on April Fool's Day. On April Fool's Day. And this is no joke, about 500,000 California fast food workers saw their wages jump as the state instituted its new fast food workers minimum wage of $20 an hour, which is $4 an hour higher than the overall minimum wage in the state. This applies to restaurant chains with more than 60 locations across the country. They are subject to this new minimum. And did the sky fall? Did the waters part? Did fire and wind destroy the Golden State? Well, I guess it depends who you ask. I guess it depends on how many, CEOs of big fast food chains, because those are mostly the people losing their minds. Some photos circulating on social media show a billboard, the drive-up board at the In-N-Out Burger on March 29th, and then on March 1st, and it shows that they raised prices. In fact, a whole 25 cents for the double-double. No increase on fries, I think 15 cents for a cheeseburger. I mean, the increases were really minimum, especially when you're talking about a $4 raise in wages. The ability to make those workers' lives better, to be able to put food on the table, do all that stuff. And a lot of the comments were, especially the whiners, complaining, well, why should I have to pay an extra 15 cents for a cheeseburger so that person can have a living wage? It's really quite remarkable when you stop and think about it. But it got me thinking, because some of the comments was, well, inflation is eating away at my wages too, which is why you should join a union and fight for better wages, hours, conditions, all of that. But on the minimum wage front, had wages kept up with the cost of living, with just the inflation, which has been broken for the last 50 years, and the last time our federal minimum wage has been raised in this country was 2009, but had wages kept up with inflation from 1968 to today, 1968, the minimum wage was $1.60 an hour, which in today's dollars, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is about $14.45 an hour. Let me say that again, $14.45, almost double what our minimum wage is today. And you go, that's been because, well, we had two presidents who weren't able, one wasn't willing, and one wasn't able to get a minimum wage increase passed. The one, Ronald Reagan, no way that was going to happen. And Obama, the last several years, there was nothing there. When I entered the workforce in 1983, minimum wage was $3.35 an hour, which again, in today's money, $10.63. So that decoupling of wages to inflation had already well begun. And thank you, Ronald Reagan, for the pay cuts that I've endured all of my life. Thanks so much. Now, had it kept up with productivity, whole different story. Back in 21, economist Dean Baker, he said, had the minimum wage kept up with the gains of the economy overall with productivity over the last 50 years, the minimum wage would be nearly $26 an hour, or more than $50,000 a year. And you got to go, well, how much would that have equated to for the cheeseburger? Maybe 16 cents? And you go, understand where the productive gains of this country have gone. They've gone to the handful, to the wealth class, to our business community. They've lined the pockets of the shareholders and the CEOs. Had our minimum wage kept up with CEO pay? Never mind. I don't even want to get into that because it's obscene. But what we've given up are all kinds of opportunities. You know, I go back to a friend who reminds me that when she went to college, back in the 60s, when, you know, $1.60 was the minimum wage, she was able on that $1.60 plus tips, on that $1.60 minimum and whatever tip she was able to make, she was able to pay her way through the University of Michigan, undergrad and law school. No student debt. While subsequently able to rent a crummy apartment and drive a jalopy car and occasionally be able to entertain herself on $1.60 an hour. Somehow, as a society, we figured out how to make sure that we didn't saddle that generation with a lifetime of college debt. You were also able to buy homes. How we did that on minimum wage incomes, I don't quite know. But it's only been the last, 20 years that we've degraded what the minimum wage is. It's the minimum at the bottom. It's the lower jobs. But there was a point at which we said, well, you should be able to at least eat. You should be able to at least, through your work, put a roof over your head. At least have the opportunity to do better. It's only been about the last 20 years that we demonize the people who go to work for the minimum wage. You know, those people who do fast food work jobs, service jobs, people who clean up and put up with our you-know-what. So it's about time we start saying, you know what, we've got to raise the bottom. And understand, you know, the fast food industry, they're going to absorb this minor increase in wages. What the corporate elites don't want is you to think that you're worth more than you're getting. They don't want to share the bigger pie. So if we can hold down the bottom and keep us all grateful that we're not there, we're not going to ask for too much. Because our wages over the last 50 years, while they've been destroyed the minimum, have also destroyed yours and mine. Because understand, this right now anger over low pay, not new. This has been going on for decades. Wages have been stagnant and declining for years, especially as they've moved healthcare costs and retirement costs onto the backs of average workers. So for me, when I see the labor energy that's out there, where Gen Z is going, we're not putting up with that. I go, it's about time. It's about time workers get paid what they create, the wealth that they create. And these fast food workers, they create a lot of wealth. It's about time they share in some of it. Seems simple to me. But the naysayers, the whiners, the complainers, the sky's going to fall. You watch. There'll be no more fast food restaurants because we'll put them all out of business. Or the other part of it, we're going to automate all those jobs. Little secret, they were going to do it anyway. So at least fight for a part of what you can get today, at least my thoughts. Want to hear yours? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jess Piper is going to be here from Blue, Missouri to share some thoughts on, hey, we're making child labor great again. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Ah, Missouri, the show me state. Yeah. Showing us just how crazy Republican policies are and how far they're willing to go to please the rich and the powerful, their corporate masters. Last week we saw in the House there in the show me state, a vote to repeal the corporate income tax. About $1 billion windfall out of corporate America. And I love the rationale. They actually had the audacity to argue, trust us, it'll trickle down. It'll much like it did in the past. And now we see the Missouri senators debating a bill not to just remove restrictions on child labor, but to ban them, get rid of them entirely, which I find, well, predictable. So Missouri showing us what extremism looks like and why one-party supermajorities are really bad. And here to share some thoughts on just how bad, I've asked Jess Piper to come talk with us. She's the executive director of Blue Missouri, bluemissouri.org, their website. Jess, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's so good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So I look at this and, you know, all of the right-wing wet dream policies seem to be now in your backyard. Cut those corporate taxes and get those kids back to work.
Well, the kids going back to work has everything to do with defunding schools and privatizing our schools, because the ultimate goal, right, is to close the public schools. And if you can't afford a school, once they strip you of your voucher, well, your kid's going to go to work. And we need child labor, right? I mean, I don't think you can find cheaper labor than child labor. So that's why it's happening. And the corporate tax thing, they did have the audacity to talk about trickle down economics. And I was like, friends, this is 50 years and we know what trickles down and it ain't money, right?
It's yellow, all right, but it's not golden honey and manna from heaven. You've got that absolutely right. But here's the thing. The fact that they're still willing to keep pushing this and that there are still people who willingly vote for this is, well, I got to tell you, mind-numbing, because I keep going, when is too far enough? When do they go too far to where even the people who wear the red hats go, man, you've gone too far. My school is now affected. It's one thing when you're going after those people, but when it does eventually hit me, when does that wake people up?
And it actually has affected people like me. You know, I live in a town of 480 people surrounded by cornfields and bean fields. You know, my town, I don't have a place to buy a gallon of milk, but I have three places to buy a pack of cigarettes, right? So our schools, 30% of our schools are on a four-day week, 30%. And they just keep falling left and right. So it has been impacting rural parts of the state for a long time. But here's the thing. The Democrats weren't running. The reason I ended up running in 2022 is because I didn't have a candidate on my ballot over and over again, and I was sick of it. So I went to vote for Joe Biden. There was nobody running for state rep. I told my husband, I came home and I was like, forget it. If nobody else is going to do it, I'm going to do it. So 40% of our seats went uncontested. So when people are like, why are people voting against their self-interest? We don't have a choice.
There's no other option. And you're absolutely right. I've been arguing this for decades now, because the Republicans in the Newt Gingrich era was masterful in making sure that every seat was contested, no matter how big of a margin it was. Democrats haven't really figured that out yet, I think.
Well, we're figuring it out. We've been preaching the message at Blue Missouri for 4 years now. And this year, we just had our filing close. We have more candidates running as Democrats than we've had since 2018.
Good.
And you know what? The school board races were yesterday. We beat Moms for Liberty candidates. We beat big money candidates. We beat dark money candidates up and down the ballot across the state. Because just like you said, even the red hats are like, enough. That's too much. You've gone too far.
And that's incredible when the no money candidates can beat the dark money candidates.
Yep.
Because then it tells you they've gone too far. And I look at the school board stuff, you know, as the moneyed interests, you know, took over our national politics, it has filtered down all the way down to the school board level, where you have billionaires funding these bad ideas that have trickled down from think tanks. I'm hoping, as we see all of these schemes, more voucher programs, more assaults on child labor, that parents go, no, I I pine for the days when we had a local school that was the heart and the soul and the center where we all went, and that's what drew us together.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I live in a tiny town. It's where we vote. It's where we go on Friday nights, where we go to watch all the plays, the pageants, everything. Everything about our town revolves around this school. It's the biggest employer. It's where a bunch of people get their health insurance. It's where a lot of kids get fed, right? And so to see them attacking these schools, and I knocked thousands of doors. I ran in a place where a Democrat hasn't run in 32 years or hasn't won in 32 years. It'll be 34. And a woman has never won. But I knocked thousands of doors, and I tell you, I did not hear one person tell me that they wanted to defund their schools. Not one said, hey, send my taxes to the local, you know, private religious school. Nobody. And when you would ask them about school choice, because it's like right to work, right? Sounds good. until you explain it to them, and they're like, I was, you know, you're saying you don't like your school? And they're like, no, I love it. Then school choice is going to tear it apart. But here's the thing. It's not popular, which is why they don't put it on the ballot. This is why they give dark money to these politicians. They can accept, there's one in Jeff City right now. He accepted $75,000 from a Missouri billionaire to defund schools. It's not popular. You see on Twitter, it's like bots and people that are making these things look popular. They're not, because I knock doors and I talk to people and I know. No one wants to defund the schools, and that lets you know they've gone too far too, because they're scared of the constituents and they're not going to put it on a ballot.
Now, what's amazing to me is that I like you, have talked to a lot of parents and a lot of people who don't want to destroy their local schools, but other people's schools not so much, because right. they've heard horrible things. Jess, there's all kinds of bad going on. There's litter boxes in classrooms, and there's all kinds of, you know, drag shows every Friday. There's all of this stuff that people are led to believe that just not true. But, you know, if you hear it enough, if it's in your ear enough, you know, you start to go, maybe it is.
That's why we counter this narrative. I mean, you hear people talking about crime, right? Crime is down. It's not up, it's down, but they hear it all the time, so they're repeating it. And that's why you have to have candidates running in small areas, so they're going out and knocking doors and talking to people in their own communities. You need boots on the ground so that they hear a message. You know, that's just like when I talk to those people about school choice, and I'm like, it's not good, friend. They're going to close the schools, and you're going to have to consolidate with Maryville. Your kid's going to have to, you know, get on a bus for 45 minutes one way. And they're like, oh my God, that's not what I meant. So that's how we counter that, is having candidates that are out knocking doors and talking to people.
Yeah, I mean, in rural areas, I think are prime for this message. Mm-hmm. Because look, I get, you go into Philadelphia, you go into, you know, Milwaukee, you go into Chicago, big cities where, you know, poverty is high, school funding, because a lot of it's dependent on property taxes, is not as high as it should be. So you have real problems, and you go, hey, we've got a building with shiny doors and faucets, and we'll give you uniforms, and here's $100 vouchers, so you can buy whatever you want. I can see how that would be enticing. But in a rural community going, look, we're going to give out, you know, vouchers, and you can go anywhere you want, you know, 4 hours away, if you can get in, and if you can afford the rest of it, but we're going to destroy your local schools. This seems to be something where Democrats should be getting in there, rolling up the sleeves, and explaining just what you said.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly what's happening. And I always say, you can give me 20 vouchers. It doesn't matter. I've got nowhere to take my kid. The closest place that I could take her is an hour away, and it's a Catholic school, and we're not Catholic. That's problematic. And that's another thing that folks don't understand. You're not, these vouchers they're giving out, they're not going to get you into that elite school. They're going to raise the tuition over the voucher so you and your ruffians stay out of their little school, right?
Yeah, they don't want you, the unwashed masses. And what's interesting, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, when Pennsylvania first had their voucher program, the first bill that came out, I had the state senator who supposedly claims he wrote it, tell me on this show that, if I got this golden ticket, I got this wonderful voucher that I could send my kid to one of the elite schools in Philadelphia, and it would cover all of the costs and the transportation. And that school for kindergarten, as I remember, was like 40 grand. And he told me it would cover all of it. And I'm going, I think you should read your own bill, Mr. Senator, because that's not at all what it says. But it's what we're led to believe.
You teach in a kindergarten that's worth $40,000.
Well, again, it goes to what you said a moment ago. They want their little... You know, they don't want us in their little enclaves. That's how they keep poor people, working class people out. And that's how they keep it exclusive. And they do, look, I would love if every school followed their model. Small class sizes, not so much on the heavy testing, experiential learning, lots of really good stuff. Maybe we follow that model instead of trying to dream up silver bullets like vouchers or cyber charters or charters or any of that.
Yeah, well, and because my daughter goes to a school where, you know, there's 20 some odd kids in her entire grade, she does get that. She does have a class, you know, a small classroom. She does have hands-on experience. Her teachers know her inside and out. They know everything about her. And so I think sometimes when we got away from community schools and we consolidated because it was easier or it was, you know, less money, that we really did lose a lot of experience for kids. You know, a lot of folks wouldn't want to send their kid maybe to a tiny little rural school like we have, but I've got nothing but praise for this place.
No, you should. I mean, and we should want that for all kids. Small classes where, like you said, teachers actually know their name and have an opportunity to connect with them instead of having, you know, when my kids were going to go to kindergarten, my oldest, we actually held a protest outside of the school board because the class size was going to be like 35 kids. And I'm like, you know, there isn't enough room for those kids to trip over each other, let alone to get the kind of individualized attention I think that they need. And what's interesting is they then, you know, the next year went and split that up into very small classes and did what I wanted to just a year later, but still got it done. But this is where I think I got to tell you, what you're talking about should resonate with every person, not just in rural communities, but in urban areas all across this country, because it's right. It's what should unite us.
It really is. And, you know, the ultimate goal, like we talked about at the beginning of this, and the reason they're rolling back, you know, child labor laws is because libertarians don't want to pay taxes. And people are like, what's that got to do with school? Well, they're paying, everyone has to pay quite a bit, you know, of taxes into schools. And schools are the last good and holy thing that we haven't privatized yet. And they want their hands on that money. And they also don't want to have to support schools. No. Go back to the person who created school vouchers. That's Milton Friedman, you know, because he was pissed about Brown v. Board. And he said, you know, if you can't afford an education for your kids, you get a rudimentary one for them and then they go to work. He said it out loud. And I don't know why people don't realize that's actually what they want. They merge these billionaires with, you know, the right wing evangelical crew. And now you got people voting against their self-interest. And so they're ultimate goal is to get rid of public schools, to have these, you know, little private schools. I think eventually they'll probably take away the vouchers. And then when you don't have a voucher and you can't afford it, there's nothing else for you to do. And so they need to roll back these laws. They need to ban it like Missouri is doing, you know, ban it and say, no, absolutely. 14-year-olds can work in, you know, in chicken plants, in processing plants. They can absolutely work in construction and roofing and that sort of thing.
But let me ask you this, because, you know, a lot of the comments I got when I talk about child labor, well, I worked when I was a kid. And look, myself, you know, when I was eight years old, I was out shoveling snow and cutting grass and doing every odd job I could possibly think of to make money. You know, I had paper route when I was nine. I had two of them when I was 11. You know, we as kids, we did a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But we didn't work on a construction site. We weren't, you know, cleaning on the kill floor of a slaughterhouse. I mean, there's differences in, hey, we have work for kids to learn and to, you know, learn the importance of a dollar and hard work and all responsibility and all that stuff. And there's another thing, having them compete with mom and dad.
Right. I mean, that's exactly what they want. And I have a lot of people, too. They're like, well, I worked on a farm. Me, too. Like, we're not talking about working for your mom and dad on the farm, you know, shoveling crap in the lot. That's not what we're talking about. I saw today that Nebraska's governor has this huge chicken operation, and a 17-year-old died yesterday at that, you know, that workplace. We see them using children, you know, in all kinds of industrial situations when they roll back the child labor law. You have in Arkansas, which just passed a voucher scheme, 95% of the people, by the way, 95% in Arkansas who got the voucher were already in a private school.
Of course they were.
And that's something people, something people need to know. But she rolled back child labor at the same time and then instituted a law where kids graduating only from public schools had to get 75 hours of community service, but they're actually going to places and working for free. And it's just, it's setting up the infrastructure to have a pipeline of kids who are forced to work. If you can get 75 hours and a school's got 400 kids, that's a lot of free labor.
That is a lot of free labor. And look, we don't often think about it that way, do we? I mean, this is going to benefit corporate America, which is why they lobby for it so heavily. But, you know, as parents, you know, again, you said a minute ago, everyone worked on their farms. As parents, you're going to protect your kids a lot differently than the guy who owns a giant corporation who you're just a number on a balance sheet for. So for me, I look at this and it should scare all of us that we're attempting to repeal the 20th century.
It really should. And I mean, you know, we all know about the Gilded Age, and that's what it feels like we're doing again. But
do
I want to say,
this is the thing. This
maybe
is where,
we don't all know about it.
No, this is why it's important that we don't allow public education to get destroyed, because there's part of me that goes that not only are they getting cheap labor and a populace that is more controllable, it's that we're not teaching kids how to think and not teaching them how to recognize when they're getting cheated or how to organize to stop it, or about democracy and the idea of a representative democracy doing what the people want and need as opposed to what the corporations want and need.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about real history, and we don't talk about real history, right? We talk about what the whitewashed history. But I wrote about this once, and people were sort of horrified, but then a lot of people were like, oh my God, that happened to me too. I started working when I was 15 at Piggly Wiggly. And you know what? I had a manager that would not leave me alone. I turned 16 and he wouldn't, all the things. We are exposing our children to adults who may not need to be in contact with children, who may, sexually harass them, who may do other things to them, or just may bully them. There's just a lot of reasons that children don't belong in certain, workspaces. There's no one, like you said, there's not a parent there to look out for them. There's not a teacher who has a background check looking out for them. Once you place your child in that corporate environment, anything goes.
So last question I've got for you. What do we do? How do we organize out of this? Because ultimately, as I've said, this isn't a red hat, blue hat issue. This is a right issue. This is a moral issue. This is what do we want to leave for our children kind of thing. What do people do? What's the marching order?
Run everywhere. Make sure that you do not have one seat on your ballot that is uncontested. And that is huge, because I can call my representative. I can call my state senator all I want. They don't call me back. They don't talk to me. They don't have to, because they don't have opposition. And they know they are going to be elected over and over again. And they are taking their marching orders from the donors. So they don't care about what I have to say. So until we oppose them, until we say we are going to have someone run against you, they're going to keep doing what they're doing. And that is the way forward. You will have opposition. You will have to answer to people.
Jess, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Jess Piper, Executive Director, Blue Missouri. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
BlueMissouri.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some interesting new polling out by Gallup. This is just one of those things where I don't know what the average American's actually thinking, because they went through and they asked, who do you like better? Who's more likable, Biden or Trump? Biden has the lead in that area, 57-37. But on honesty and trustworthiness, it closes a little bit. People trust Biden 46-35 over Trump, which 35% trust Trump, really? But Trump has this big advantage in leadership, which I'm still trying to figure out, 57-38. Trump has gained a modest edge in managing the government 49-39, which, did you not remember the 4 years? And this is the one that gets my attention. Cares about people like you and your needs. 48% said Biden, 42% Trump. But here's the one. This is the kicker. Displays good judgment in a crisis. 45% preferred Trump over Biden. 40% said Biden. And I go, do you not remember the guy who suggested shoving light up your you-know-what and drinking bleach? I don't know if that's good during a crisis. But here to share some thoughts on, maybe I'm missing something. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come talk with us. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So what do you make of this? I mean, you know, 45-40, Trump over Biden in the good judgment during a crisis situation. I got to tell you, I'm confused.
Well, I mean, look, one thing, drinking bleach, you know, less people then will get treated because they won't be around on the planet, you know? I mean, that doesn't make sense when you think about it. And of course, remember something too, I think, Rick, that we're now talking about I forgot about the bleach, okay? I totally forgot about that. There's a lot of things where time's passed and people, I think, have probably forgotten some things. They'll remember some things, obviously, but they might have also forgotten some things. The parade when he was in the hospital, remember that? He did a parade. He left the hospital with COVID, right?
Yep.
Okay, I think people forget that. That's not very responsible. Now, in the polling, I can understand where, you know, Biden would definitely come out on top as the, you know, nicer guy or the more likable guy. I think there's no question about that because of Trump. You know, he picks on people a lot. But on the leadership thing, most likely, I'm thinking, and this is a weird way this has come down, but one thing about Trump that has amazed me, whether it was the John McCain statement and he likes, you know, veterans that can fly planes and don't crash them, you know, whatever it is, Trump never backtracks or apologizes per se. All right. Never does.
No, I don't think Republicans in general do.
Yeah. Well, and Trump's mastered the art, you know, of just, well, no, I didn't say that. Well, here's the video. I don't care. I didn't say that. With Biden, and it doesn't happen all the time, but there are times where he will, you know, I remember some heat because of something to do with the Gaza-Israeli situation, something he didn't recognize. There were some Muslims at the White House or something, and he, you know, he apologized for that. He should have recognized them. And, you know, and some other examples. So I think that the machine of Trump and the surrogate machines of Trump have turned those types of things into weakness. After the State of the Union, where he basically apologized for calling, you know, the guy an illegal, which is a term that was used all the time to differentiate legal immigration issues and illegal immigration issues. And he came out with a statement. Of course, they jumped on that. So I think some of this is a perception because the Trump camp organization side effect people are pretty good at just jumping on it. When you jump on Trump, what does he respond? I don't care.
Yeah. I don't care. And more craziness.
I don't care.
He'll say something actually crazier.
Right. And, you know, at first I thought some of it was a mistake and it's not. I think it's intentionally done to change a story, grab a headline,
yep.
Because again, he's not going to apologize or backtrack. So that part of the polling, I guess I can understand. Now on leadership, I think that the Biden administration has done a terrible job on getting the message out of exactly, you know, what they did. They would do an infrastructure bill and they announced it, et cetera. But I don't think they did enough preliminary farm work, I'll call it, out in the field. And I know they didn't do enough follow-up work. They took surrogates out maybe last month, for example. Should have had them all out there right away, for a period of time, you know, doing some town halls, visiting, doing projects. Now they're doing some of that now. So I think that Biden, who I know from the news stories is puzzled about the numbers, but I think some of the leadership thing comes from the fact that Biden has yet, he's got time, he has yet to be able to translate, here's what I did, here's how it affects you, this is better for you, the working people. He's got to do that.
No, I absolutely agree. They don't take credit for the things that they do, and the things that they get attacked on, they apologize for, which is, I don't know, just twisted. But, you know, mm-hmm. again, it comes back down to we have a media culture that keeps feeding people with all of this horrible news and keeps propping, you know, Trump up in a way that he looks more decisive. You know, he's a bully, so, you know, even if he's wrong, you know, it looks like he's decisive. Decisively wrong, but still, and I think some people mistake that potentially for leadership.
Well, that's a very good point, because there, I don't know if you've seen this yet. There's a video out there. I don't know if you want to call it a meme, but I guess it's a video. And it shows the scene. You remember when Trump was at a NATO meeting, and he kind of shoves his way out like this and walks in front of them?
Yep.
And they play this song from a movie, and it's like, you know, a real tough song, blah, blah, blah. And he's moving out there, and they're showing that. And then they play this music that goes doo, 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 like that. And it shows Biden, you know, walking somewhere and turning and looking another direction. And it shows some world leaders who weren't standing next to him, et cetera. There's another one of Trump coming along, and it says, you can't touch Mohammed bin Salman, you know, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And it shows Trump smacking him on the shoulder, and Mohammed bin Salman looks this way. There's a lot of them. I have probably unsolicited, just when I'm going through, you know, the different types of Instagram and things, looking at what's going on, I have probably seen those pop up, Rick, I want to say in a month's period of time, at least 20 times.
No, there is a machine out there that's built to get people to think this way, which is why I wanted to get your thoughts on this. I don't know if you saw the New York Times article, opinion piece by Thomas Edsel, you know, titled Trump backers are now determined not to blow it this time. And it talks all about, you know, the $2 billion political machine that's behind him that's pushing this kind of stuff. And also, you know, Project 2025, which we've talked about on this program, Leonard Leo's, Federalist Society, which, you know, packed our court. But there's a machine that most people don't know exists that put this stuff right in front of us, force feed us most of this stuff every day. And we don't even know, most of us, that it actually exists.
Right. When John McCain brought his campaign finance bill into my committee, the House Administration Committee, which had oversight over the Federal Elections Commission and election law, when he brought that bill in, I killed it the first round. McCain became furious. He brought it a second time. And then Chris Shays of Connecticut, a Republican, was getting a discharge petition, which eventually forced us to discharge the bill, which I did, unapproved. Now, the reason I went through all of that, I said time after time, McCain was talking about the corporate and union soft money. And he would say soft money is so bad. And I would ask people, what's soft money? And they would say, I don't know, but it's bad. You know, because McCain was, you know, beating that drum. Now, what we tried to point out and failed is that once he eliminated soft money, which is fine, okay? I'm not arguing that was what then prompted everything else, but McCain was selective of what he was eliminating. You will decrease the amount people can give. You will do this and you will do that. But he created a huge hole that you could drive three Mack trucks through, because he created something that was taking the 501c3s, the 501s that should have been charity issues and should have been charity groups, and he was allowing for monies to be brought in, $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion, and they can be brought in under the cover of night. You don't have to claim who's doing it. So if somebody has, it's like the Supreme Court and Thomas, you know, If somebody has an objective and they're not accountable and nobody knew about Thomas till recently, then they can do a lot of damage. They can do a lot of things. That's what's going on with these groups. So they can have somebody that wants to really have an influence on the EPA. I'll give you this for example. This is just one aspect, because the groups will do more. And they're one of these three big contributors to these three sources right now. And there'll be more that are putting this together for Trump in anticipation of him becoming president. So they want to have a corporate advantage on EPA. They're funneling in billions of dollars undetected. And then when the 2025 hits, then they have patronage, because they're going to put people in key positions that pass the litmus test, which is, first, was the election stolen? Two, do you love Donald Trump? Well, first, do you love Donald Trump? Two, was the election stolen? And they're going to be able to control patronage. Yep. Nobody's talking about this.
No, look, the day the Heritage Foundation came out with this Project 2025, which is what you're talking about, this is what I said, we're making patronage great again. Right. Because what they want to do, and they've already said this, Trump has been very clear about it. He wants to use this something called Schedule F to go in and fire all the federal employees that are sufficiently not loyal enough. And then they're going to replace them. And this Heritage Foundation project is going to go out and vet those people. So on day one, they can come in, do the firing, and bring in their little brown shirts or their well-vetted loyalists to do what they are told to do. And this is, I think, a central issue that the Democrats should be hammering on day after day after day.
Well, they also... With the 2025, we'll be able to reduce government where they want and then increase it on the other end where they want. It won't be just a general reduction. They'll be able to do that, you know, plus the patronage, which you've talked about, and I've just mentioned the patronage. Here's the other thing, too, that's really bad about this. You've got to make, I don't care what your policy is as president, and I mean, it's important, but when I say I don't care, if you want the government to run, you have to have the trains run on time, trains and the trucks. They've got to run on time, right? And if they replace people, because just look at the Republican National Committee, a Republican organization. Day one, when they changed the leadership, day one, 60 people were fired of 200 some people that worked there. Day one, 60. So throughout the government, as they do the Schedule F and they fire people, what they will do is replace with people that are loyalists and people that will do what they are told to do. That doesn't mean they can make the agencies run. So these agencies are probably going to be at the mercy of people who are not skilled, are not in the classified positions they should be in to actually make this government work, because put all the politics aside, the government needs to work.
See, but I may disagree just a little bit on this, mm-hmm. because I see this as the privatization of government. I see this as, you know, we're going to vet sufficiently loyal people, but people who know the agencies well enough to run them, but just not in our favor, just not in our interests, in that of the corporate interest, to be able to undo all the regulations, all the rules, all of the things for decades that have been fought for and passed, all of the protections in workplaces and in the environment. I just see bad out of all of this. My fear is not that they put in incompetent brain dead people. My problem would be that they put in people who are skilled at destroying our government and privatizing it.
Well, I mean, we're kind of saying the same thing in the sense, my mind went a little different direction in this sense. They're going to have people in there. They're not that skilled, but they're yes people. And there's always lawyers throughout these agencies. And the people that are controlling the money are going to make sure that those people do the right decisions, or they will be Machiavellian astute to do it on their own. One way or the other, they will do what they're told to do.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But what do you say to the person who goes, but Bob, we already have that. Every time there's an administration, all of the old people go, they bring in their political appointees. Isn't that the same thing?
No, this goes further. This is fascinating when it comes to a entity thought out that replaces the White House personnel office, basically, is what this is doing. They're making a hybrid. It will become the White House personnel office. normally, yes, the positions where, you know, they're appointed positions, of course, most people understand, okay, they're gonna quit, they're gonna be fired. They understand that. That's part of the process, right? Now, not all people go. Sometimes people are kept, but the top brass will go, and then they will be filled, you know, with people that have been looked at by White House personnel. Now, in this case, this is going way beyond it. Not just the top brass. This is going to filter down to the janitor. And this is going to filter down through the system.
Yep,
is what it'll do.
No, because if you listen to Trump and his whining and complaining, what he wasn't able to accomplish was to get the bureaucrats, the people whose their job to do the mission of those agencies, to do whatever he wanted them to do. They were tasked with doing what Congress or what the law was supposed to be, not what the benevolent dictator said, you do.
Now, imagine also one other scenario that may not be important, but I want to mention it. Imagine the tattletaling that is going to go on, where one person wants another position and goes in and says, well, they're not Trump loyal. They said they were. They're not. I mean, there's going to be all kinds of chaos, too. On the other end of
it. I got to tell you, though, there's a part of me, a sadistic part of me, that goes, you know, this might be fun to watch. I mean, while Rome is burning, there has to be some entertainment. And maybe this could be it. Or then there's the sane, rational part of me goes, please, no, I lived through 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House. No, this will be worse because the moneyed interests now understand that they can get involved. And I got to think, since this is so public, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because they have come out in such a public way of saying, we're going to do this Project 2025, and Leonard Leo's at the front of his network, and you've got all these moneyed interests doing all of these things, that Trump's got to have some buy-in to this as well, that he's going to allow them and empower them to do all of the evil things they want to do.
Well, of course he will. I mean, because with Trump, I mean, look at how he functioned. He would get reports from people. John Bolton's the best example. Trump praised John Bolton, not like he does a lot of people he hired. This guy's brilliant, on and on. Trump took Bolton because wealthy people told Trump to take Bolton. So he took Bolton. He listened to him. He cut the Iran deal off. Bolton convinced him he could get a better deal. And what ended up happening is the United States made the mullahs more powerful than ever before, right? So when you look at this, the kind of scary thing is that people will be coming and you'll have the vested interests and the wealthy telling them to tell Trump certain things that, you know, Trump may not even question at all. So that's another scary aspect of this.
No, there's nothing good here, which is why, again, come November, the hope is he gets nowhere near the White House, not even on a tour, because not good things, not good things. But, Bob, as always, appreciate the thoughts, the expertise. I'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You concerned about this Project 2025? You know, for me, there's two things that have destroyed this country in irreparable ways. Uncle Milton Friedman and his economic rhetoric, and the Heritage Foundation and all of the things that they have done. This kind of, I think, being the top of it. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered by an assassin's bullet in Memphis, Tennessee. He was in Memphis to support AFSCME sanitation workers who were out on strike fighting for better wages and working conditions. In the later 1960s, Dr. King's organizing had increasingly turned toward addressing the poverty, unemployment, and unfair working conditions faced by black workers. As we pause to honor the memory and legacy of Dr. King today, let us take a moment to reflect on his words. In a message he delivered to a gathering of Teamster Local 815 shop stewards on May 2nd, 1967. In his speech, Dr. King discussed the wave of labor organizing in the 1930s. He recounted the difficulties faced by workers forging new unions. He said, yet there was one thing that was won, one thing that was fought for as indispensable, one thing for which all the pain and sacrifice was justified, namely union recognition. It seemed so minuscule a victory that people outside the labor movement scorned it as, in fact, just another defeat. But those who understood, union recognition meant the real beginning. Union meant strength, and recognition meant the employer's acknowledgement of that strength. And the two meant the opportunity to fight again for further gains with united and multiplied power. As contract followed contract, the pay envelope fattened, and fringe benefits and job rights grew to the mature work standards of today. All of these started with winning first union recognition. Dr. King died standing up with black workers fighting for that very recognition. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email us. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, I listen to Bob, and the more we talk about this Project 2025 and what's coming, the more I think we should be very, very afraid. And look, what's happening in the red hat, blue hat world, you look at what the red hats are doing, and it's all about controlling government, privatizing government, and education, a huge part of this. And I look at Ohio, where I have relatives in Ohio who they live in school districts where the ballot initiative, the levy tax that they wanted to raise the levies in these school districts, most of them all failed. And that means no new money going into the public schools. So that means, classes are going to be cut. Class sizes are going to be increased. Extracurricular programs are going to be shot. All of the things that I remember my school experience being like, all going to be gone. But Ohio masterfully gave the privateers and the profiteers a $1 billion bailout when they passed their voucher nonsense and all of these gimmicks that they're giving out. And understand, these vouchers, these golden tickets, these wonderful windfalls of educational opportunity that they give great names like opportunity scholarships, don't go to the kids who really need them. And what we find out all across the country is these vouchers are going to people who are already having their kids in private schools. So this is really a windfall for wealthy people, the ones who can afford to send their kids to private schools, and also a lot of religious schools as well. And I think Jess Piper said it earlier when she said, look, I could send my kid to a private school with a voucher, but it's a Catholic school, but I'm not Catholic. Well, you could convert. If education was really that important to you, that would be the argument. So the thing that gets me is these are tax dollars that are going into these private ventures. And every time I turn around, there's a new gimmick from tech world about, hey, there's this new fangled thing we're gonna sell to education and corporate. And look, public schools don't generally buy them. The private ones do. Because, hey, anything we can do to reduce costs of people, that's where we're going to head. And I got to tell you, I'm not looking forward to the future of privatized education, because understand what that means. As a working person, those opportunities are going to be few and far between. And look, and you're already seeing them laying the groundwork. Well, if you can't get an education, we're going to open up the opportunities of employment. Yeah, kids, you go to eighth grade, make you just functional to read and write. We'll put you to work in those industrial farms like they want to do in Indiana. Or yeah, kids, if you want to get into an apprenticeship at school, that apprenticeship puts you on the kill floor at the meat plant. The company's not responsible if you get injured. The school's not responsible if you get injured. Who does that leave? Leaves you. But you got to have a little skin in the game. So we're really honestly, truthfully, repealing the 20th century. And I've been saying this for a while. Conservatives want to repeal the New Deal and all of the progress that happened in the 20th century. All of those things that built a prosperous middle class, a prosperous working class, and gave people an opportunity to go, you know what? If I work hard and play by the rules, I can get ahead. And they don't want that. They want good, desperate, obedient workers. People are going to show up and do what they're told and not ask too many questions. Question is when are we going to stop them? Because I look at all of this money, all of this wealth that's being transferred from our kids and their future to these billionaires and these corporations. And yet we hear, you know, the government's spending too much money. Government's spending money. They're running up debt. They don't care. They don't want you to think about how much we're giving them out of the education budget. And the thing that really, I got to tell you, and I'm sure you've heard this as well, the thing that really irks me is every time I turn on the radio, I'm hearing an advertisement for cyber charters or charter schools or the next newfangled thing that's going to replace my local public school. Instead of saying, hey, instead of wasting money on, you know, enriching this media company to convince me that these wonderful little things are so fabulous, why don't we just, I don't know, invest that money in the local school? That thing that brought us all together, that thing that gave us all a common bond. Huh, there's an idea. I want to hear your thoughts. Good, bad, in favor? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, as always, or check out freespeech.org for the video. As always, appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.